of love we meet for the world anew.
Welcome to Muffin Talk.
Kia ora and welcome to Muffin Talk. This radio program is brought to you by the initiative Titi Paunamu, Study and Joy. Muffin Talk is a weekly radio program to which I invite guests to talk about their work and their passion for issues on community programs, social justice, Bible studies, or interfaith relations. Today, I've invited Gatluwak Chuol to a Zoom recording for broadcast. Gatluwak, a warm welcome and hi to my radio program.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for welcoming me. Thank you so much.
I hope that I pronounced your name correctly. Gatluwak Chuol is originally from Sudan, Africa. He had to flee his home when he was very young and then spent many years as a refugee in different refugee camps. Since 2015, he lives in Aotearoa, New Zealand, and has been involved in community and advocacy work. Gatluwak, Sudan borders countries like Egypt, Eritrea, Ethiopia, the Central African Republic, and other countries. It used to be one of the biggest countries in Africa, and there are big deserts, but also there's very fertile land along the River Nile, which is the biggest river in Africa. What are the reasons for you to become a refugee? It sounds so beautiful.
Thank you again for welcoming me. So my pleasure. So how I become a refugee? You know, sometimes you don't know what would happen in your life, right? So no one would wake up one day and say, oh, I need to leave everything I know behind and then let me flee to another country. You know, all the family you have been known to and the friends and relatives, and then you leave them behind. There's no human being would do that, you know, at will. So something has forced you to do it. I did not have a choice just to flee. So to take you back, maybe a little bit of a story, like you mentioned, Sudan is the biggest country in Africa by size and by land. But there was a story of a conflict. You know, it started as a religion conflict and then it went to the political. It has been, you know, a war since the colonial time. And Sudan was colonized not by only one colonizer, but by so many colonizers. You know, you got the British, you got the Turkish, and the French came and left. And then the Arabs, you know, we call them Anglo-Egyptian. You know, the Egyptians came. It's a complete mess. So those civil wars, it started in 1955. You know, South Sudan wanted to be independent, and we are the minority in the country, and they are the Christians, and the north is Islamized. So those issues continued, and no one could resolve them. So, and then it triggered civil war, and in the civil war, it has been an on and off with genocides, ethnic cleansing, and all that. So, sadly enough, it was South Sudan where the wars were fought. Now, one of them, as I can remember, when I was a child, they used to come to the villages, take the children away, you know, or come kill anything that's alive. You know, and it's very devastating. So it was way back in 1983, just when they changed the country into Islamic state. So they call it Sharia law. So everything has to be in Islamic law. It doesn't matter which one you believe in.
So the Sharia was the law for the whole country.
For the whole country. You don't even go to church on Sunday. So forget about Christmas. Forget about the rest. So it you have to follow the Islamic laws. So that triggered a rebellion from the southern part of the country where I come from. And then a war broke out, civil war. And, you know, they came to our village one day, you know, cleaning it up. That's how they call it, even cutting down the trees, kill anything that moves. And so I fled to Ethiopia, me alone, because, they came to clean the villages up. You know, the government forces come through the ground with the tanks and they come with the airplanes, you know, the bombs. So I fled to Ethiopia by myself because we are disarray. It was a war. I did not know where my family was. And I was, I think at the time I was 13 years old, so fled to Ethiopia. Stayed there as a refugee in a refugee camp. And then my family joined me later, some months later.
So you say you were 13 years old and you fled without your family, all by yourself?
Without family, it's so traumatizing, you know. It's like, and you have to do some strategies to survive, though, you know. Yeah. Like, you know, we have to walk at night because at day they can see you, they follow us with bombs. And even I saw one guy was caught, I knew the guy, they got him, you know, they tied him on the tree and then they poured gasoline on him, they burned him alive. And it was like, I could not forget the images, you know. I was like, I was hiding in the bush and yeah, so many things, you know.
You had to flee. You had to flee of the people who were trying to kill you. But there would have also been rivers or animals that could be a danger. How did you survive going? How far is it to Eritrea?
So, that must be a- the good thing about. Me at that time, you know, I grew up along the river, so we have so many rivers, so I get used to identifying which area has so many crocodiles, you know, which area. So you have to develop some strategies, you know, and would be like, oh, I cannot cross here because it looks like it would be a hub for crocodiles. And, oh, this area maybe have so many poisonous snakes, so... yeah, but sometimes you don't have a choice because if they start dropping bombs, so you have to dip into the river. So that's the only safe space for you, you know.
So how long did it take you to get to Eritrea from this situation?
From Ethiopia, it would be a distance for like in a normal day, it would take you maybe for 3 weeks or 1 month. But it took us a few months to get there because you don't have to go straight. You know? Maybe you have to hide in a bush maybe for half of the day or for a day. And then if they're not there, and then you start walking at night. Yeah, that's a story for any South Sudanese. Maybe some of them went through a tough time than myself. You know, I heard stories from some of my friends. They were trying to drink the urines, but they did not have urine because they crossed to the area where there's no water and just a semi-desert. And yeah.
Anyway, when you said we, how many people were together with you when you were running away?
I could not remember, but we met on the road because you see people. The advantage I had, I spoke the language of the local language there, so I understand what people are saying. I did not even know where I was going. And then I was asking, where are people going? People are going to Ethiopia. Well, like, okay, just join them. No, just walk with them. And then on the road, and then people add, maybe you end up with around 300 people. And then when they throw bombs, maybe you find yourself only two people or three people together. You don't know where the rest were. You know, yeah, that's craziness. So I was, got to a refugee Ethiopian camp. At the time, it was one of the biggest camps in the world, I think. Over 2 million refugees.
2 million?
Yeah. So, like, crazy.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, like crazy.
Gatlu, when you mentioned the history, you said that there was you had the south and the north, and I guess this is why in 2011 the country has been divided between the northern part with a majority of Arabs and Islamic rules, and the southern part where you have people who are predominantly Christian or belong to natural religions.
Yeah.
So when the country was divided, I remember I was working with a Sudanese priest at the time in a campaign in Germany. He was so much full of hope for peace in the future and for the region. How has the situation developed since?
When South Sudan became independent, everybody was happy. You know, our friends, you know, we had a lot of friends from all over the world. You know, we have the Americas, the two Americans, you know, the North and the South America. And we have the Europe and we have the Pacific. We have friends all over the world. You know, we thought we will manage ourselves, You know, because that's what we wanted. We want to be a separate people, you know, create a space which is good for any faith we have, you know, and because all along we have been saying, leave the religion aside, you know, let's be people first, and then you can practice any religion you want to practice. So this is what was missing in that administration. But when we became independent in 2011, 9 July 2011, 2 years later, another civil war started within South Sudan. So it's still going on now. It's like we have not even learned from those 4 or 5 civil year long, you know, and not even Sudan. Because when South Sudan left, and North Sudan maintained the name Sudan, so they are called Republic of Sudan. They maintain that name. So we become South Sudan, the Republic of South Sudan. So both Sudans, none of them is stable.
Oh my
so
God.
South Sudan is fighting itself, North Sudan is fighting itself. So it's like, what was the point of fighting in the first place if we continue fighting? Now it's still both countries are producing refugees, but like, so what was the point in fighting in the first place, you know? So it's crazy. It's still going on now.
Isn't South Sudan rich in resources?
Yeah, yeah. That's what one of my friends, American friend, was telling me. If you have, you know, the natural resources like oil, gold, and diamond and all that,
yeah,
forget about peace. It will never have peace because it will be... Yeah, we'll be messed all the time. And we learned that from countries in that situation, like Congo, close to us. So they have never seen stability as well. So, yeah.
So when you said earlier, so you were in a refugee camp, and that was 2011 when Sudan was divided. You still have the refugee camps. You went into the refugee camp in the late 1980s, correct?
Yeah.
And how long did you stay there? I guess they are still staying. The refugee camps are still there.
They're still there. They're still there. And that time we had only three refugee camps in Ethiopia. And now, I don't know, they have camps everywhere. At the time when I was there, a little bit of that background, Ethiopia was in a communist state. You know, it was led by a communist agenda. Mengistu Haile Mariam was the president at the time. And when we came, you know, we had this Sudanese rebels and all that, and then we all come to the camp. And then there was issue of education because refugee children were not allowed to go to school. And that was one of my hardest, one of my difficult times, you know, trying to continue with my education, but there was no way. And even there was a time I changed my name and then went to Ethiopian school thinking I would not be identified, but I was taken out with men of children, the refugee children there. So it was very difficult time. So what I did was, We had a small tent, and then me and my two cousins, we got somebody to teach us, you know, with ABCs in that tent and hiding, you know, from the people. We did not have any pen or pencil, and we just write on the sand, you know. We make it a little wet, and then we write that. That's how I started.
And so you were really fighting for education.
For education, but you don't have the opportunity, you know.
And, oh, my God.
Yeah. And one day we talked to one of our church pastor because the number, you know, we become 5 and we don't fit into the 10. And then we talked to the guy if we can come to the church. He was like, okay, yeah, you can use it for teaching. And we brought the guy. We used to sell our food and give it to him, you know. To hire somebody as our tutor. But it's still the church, no blackboard, no pencil, nothing. So what we did, we go to the market, buy the cow skin, you know, the butcher, we get the cow skin. We take the hair out, we dry it, it becomes like hot, and then we put, you know, the battery, the black thing in the battery, then we put it on the cow skin, it becomes a blackboard. So now,
my God.
So now the issue is what to write with. And then we were like, okay, we've got the powdered milk. We buy it from the shop and then we put it in the sun. It becomes like a stone. And then we cut it. It becomes a chalk.
My God, you were really creative. My God.
So we give it to our teacher. That's how he started, you know, teaching us. So this is how my education started, you know.
That is amazing.
And yeah. And then three years later, Ethiopian government changes the tune and say, no refugee children should go to school. And at that time, I started to know ABC and a little bit of English, you know, with some learning. And then we were given examination, and then I passed, and then I started the intermediate school. And the UN was like, okay, come on in. If you study hard and you get a good grade, they might take you to a better school.
Yeah.
Then I studied hard, got a good grade, and then I was taken to a better school. So that's the journey, you know.
Tell me, did you feel safe in the refugee camps?
No safety at all, because the camp was at the border of Ethiopia and Sudan. So they would come and attack people. So that's why they did not allow school children, refugee children to go to school, because they might take them in big numbers.
Okay.
So, yeah, a lot of times, even I was get caught and was to be taken to the, as a child soldier, but, you know, I tried to find a way to run away. Yeah.
They tried to get you as a child soldier.
Yeah, that's what they do. They come and take people. And
even in the refugee camp?
Even in the refugee camp, because it was a complete mess. The camp was not holding to the UN laws, you know. It was like a military too. So
yeah.
Yeah. The only thing about it was like there was a lot of food.
Okay, that's did you change? You changed to refugee camps? Is that correct? Did you?
Yeah. In Ethiopia, I stayed in one refugee camp. I stayed for 11 years in Ethiopia in total. So when I completed my high school, I was so happy. You know, I was like, oh, now I can get my dreams together, go to uni, study, because I believe the education would be the only way to change my life and the life of my family. Yeah, holding onto that hope, you know, then the president of Ethiopia was thrown, you know, there was a military coup, and then it was, yeah, he ran away. So another mess now. So Ethiopia became another conflict zone. So it was in a war. Death everywhere. So I had to run again to Kenya. The same way I came to Ethiopia. So in the same way, I ran from Ethiopia to Kenya. Start life again, all over again as a refugee. So when we went to Kenya. Got to the refugee camp close to Ethiopia. Yeah, we were received there. But the funny thing is, it doesn't matter whether you're a refugee there, so you have to register again, you know, to seek protection again. So, like, there's no data to show, oh, you have been a refugee in this country, so it's good, just welcome, and, you know, we will transfer your records from there to here. No, nothing like that. So you have to start all over again and be questioned why you left and all that.
Yeah,
it does make sense.
And how did you come to New Zealand?
So New Zealand, I started my family in Kenya, because I lived there for another 11 years as well. So in total, 22 years as a refugee. So my family came to New Zealand first. I got stuck somewhere in a war zone in Sudan, and my family came here. Qualified for women at risk program is one of the programs the UN and New Zealand government share together. So yeah, I did not know. So when I came back, my family is here, and went to the States, because this is one of the settlement issues. So you don't get linked up with the family, so you take the whatever is available. You know, you don't have a choice where to go. They tell you where to go.
So when you say this is the leadership of the refugee camp,
United Nations.
The United Nations.
Because the thing is, you get protected as a refugee, right? You get that protection, the asylum, and then you become a refugee. Then you get another step to go. Why you think you should be resident to a third country. Why? So you're like, you know, like a court case where you have to win a case, you have to build a case why you deserve, out of these 2 million refugees, why you need to be the only one to go. So you have to build a very good case, you know. Yeah, and so once they approve your case, and then we will put it there, and the settlement country that comes, or they will be like, so and so, go to this one, so you don't have a choice to say no.
Ah, so your family was taken to New Zealand, and you went to America first.
To America, so we have to find a way how we can come together, but also there's the law here, you know, you have become the citizen first. So I tried to come and see my family, but I was not American citizen at the time. And then I would say, you know, with New Zealand laws, you know, you have to be like, you know, American citizen to come here. Otherwise, you know, there's no proof that you will not go back. You know, one of those boxes with immigration, you know, I was not mad, you know, the same America would do to them too. You know, one of those, but I was saying, you know, We are good, we are safe, because first is safety.
Yeah. And so that's almost 18 years ago that you arrived here.
I came in 2015. It's now 8 years.
Yeah. So yeah. Do you remember what your first impressions were when you came to New Zealand?
Oh, man, yeah. Very, 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 still, I remember that. It's a very big one. When I first came to New Zealand, I came through Auckland Airport, and then I got my bags checked, and, you know, people were friendly, chatting to them, because I like to talk to people. And two police officers came, you know, a male and a female police officers, and they were having a dog, you know, sniffing the bags and all that. And I said, hey, excuse me. They stopped, and I was like, are you police officers, or are you a very weird question, I don't know why. Are you police officers or guards? They were like, oh, no, we are the police officers, you know, very polite. We are police officers. And why you ask that question? I was like, I asked that question because in my life, I have never seen a police officer without a gun.
Really?
Yeah. They were like, oh, okay. And now they are interested. They were like, oh, where do you come from? I originally from Sudan. And they were like, yeah, here in New Zealand, we're not allowed to carry guns unless it is, there's a threat. But are you sure? I need to come here. And they were like, what brought you here? I said, my family's here. One, and the lady was like, yeah, man, you better not go back.
Isn't that a wonderful experience?
That put a light on them too. Somebody like, you know, a random person to ask why, why you're not carrying it down. And true, that was my first time you see a police officer without a gun.
Yeah.
Then in my mind I was like, no, this country is too peaceful.
It's too peaceful. And have you been back to Sudan since?
When they declared the independence in 2011, I was there.
Yeah.
I was there.
Yeah. So you came from the United States to visit?
Yeah, I to go there. So I said I need to witness that. No.
Yes.
I never knew there would be another civil war coming.
Wow, that's so sad.
So with all that suffering, you know, when we come here, that's where another journey started too, because when we have the issues like, you know, the discrimination, lack of employment and all that, you know, we think we are better compared to where we were. You know, that's why most of the refugees don't complain, because they think they are in a better position than they used to be. And it will take someone to tell them no. You need to be like everybody else. You don't need to, you know, you don't need to experience all that, you know, the racism, unemployment and all that. So it's like, even we have this fear, oh, if I speak up, you know, something might happen to me, because we come back from the background where we were ruled by bad governments, you know, we still, the mindset is still there. You know?
Yeah. So they wouldn't complain, yeah.
Yeah, well, like, you know, we are thankful with what we have.
Yeah. And tell me, what is it what you miss in New Zealand? Because as I said in the beginning, Sudan seems to be, if you leave the war aside, Sudan must be a beautiful country. And you grew up alongside the river, so you do remember when you were a child and when it was still peaceful, don't you?
Yeah. Oh, man, I'm so attached to the water. Even here in New Zealand, I just go to the beach, not to play there, but just to look at the water and praise, you know, whatever is God has given us, you know, the water, the life, the nature. I'm like, you know, I think as humanity, we are very lucky to have that. So I'm attached to the water, and one of the things I missed, when I went back in 2011, I said, I need 1 month in the village. You know, no light, no cell phone, no internet, just 1 month there. And I was like, let me try to go back to the past. it made me feel better.
Yeah.
You know, get to know people again, the people you departed with, you know, about 30 years ago.
Yeah. And let's hope that one day you can go back with your children and that you can show them a peaceful Sudan. So that's...
Yeah, hopefully so. We have relatives there. You know, we have aunties, uncles, nephews. Some are born there. We don't even know. You know, just on the phone. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So one day will come, you know, they will go and see where we come from. But they know the history.
Yeah. And they know the language?
Like I've been telling refugee kids, you know, if the family did not make a move to leave the country, you would be one of those kids being fed on TV now, you know. So you appreciate the fact that you got parents.
Yes.
Some kids, they do not have that opportunity.
And do your children speak your local language?
Yeah. Some of them, they do.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you. Thank you so much for sharing these experiences and for giving us a little bit of an insight of a refugee life also, because I think it's often not seen. People think, oh, these are refugees that come straight from a situation that is really bad. Mm-hmm. But actually, many of the refugees I've met, they spent years in refugee camps before they arrived in a country like New Zealand.
Yeah, I think the journey has a lot to do with healing too, because we come here with a lot of baggage. You know, we come a lot of us come with a very high trauma. You know, a trauma of maybe you can find that in some families, you might be the only survivor. You know, who survived the war, and when we come to New Zealand, you know, we are trying to find where we can belong, you know, and the belonging here, it can start small, you know, somebody opening up to you. Sometimes you may only need somebody to talk to you.
Yeah.
And you feel better.
Thank you so much, Gatluak. That is really, thank you for sharing this.
And, thank you.
Maybe another day we talk about another topic from your life with all this experience that you've had. And as the interview is ending now, I'd just like to point out a few events that are coming up with Titipona Mo Study and Joy. So we'll have with Leticia Putin-Badat, four sessions on the topic Focus on Target, Draw Fresh Momentum. It is to stop and reflect and going forward to the new year. It starts on Wednesday, the 15th of February, and it will be four consecutive Wednesday at 12:30 to 1:30. And then we have also two-part series on Genesis in the beginning. The first part is the creation story with Brother Kieran Finn, and that is on the 27th of February, where we lay the foundation of knowing what the creation story is about and the stories. And then the second part is Creation of Adam from Fenua. And this is referring to the picture, the painting of Michelangelo, and the presenter is Dr. Christopher Longhurst. This will be on the 6th of March, 7 to 8:30 p.m. All these sessions are on Zoom. And for more information or current and past programs, please check out www.studyjoy.nz. Kia kaha, keep safe, and thank you very much, Gatluak.
Thank you so much. Thank you.